Welcome to Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Kathy Bessant to the broadcast. Kathy is the Chief Operations and Technology Officer of Bank of America, a $90 billion global banking and financial services corporation. Since 2010, Kathy's led the team responsible for delivering end-to-end technology and operating services across the company. She's held a number of senior leadership roles at B of A. A partial list includes President of Global Corporate Banking, President of Global Product Solutions and Global Treasury Services, and Chief Marketing Officer. Kathy serves on the board of directors of Zurich Insurance Group and Florida Blue. She also sits on the board of trustees for the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and on the advisory board for the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. Kathy holds a bachelor's degree in business administration from the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. I recently caught up with Kathy in her office in Charlotte, North Carolina, and our conversation covered world-class IT principle one, people, as Kathy discussed the shortage of tech talent and the importance of talent planning and analysis. Principle four, IT and business partnerships, as she discussed the organization-wide benefits of integrating technology and operations. And principle five, external partnerships, as Kathy laid out the guidelines she follows for maximizing relationships with fintech companies and other partners. We also discussed responsible automated intelligence, the opportunities that scale offers to large enterprises, Kathy's board experiences, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you'd give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Bessant, welcome to the Forum on World Class IT.
Great to be here, thanks.
We've spoken before, and we had a great conversation that included some insights about your purview over both technology and operations at Bank of America. Now, several years down the road, if anything, the trend towards the intersection of those two disciplines has become more profound. You see it with a number of executives who've taken on both sets of responsibilities as you have, sort of walking in your footsteps, if you will. You see it even at a more granular level with topics like DevOps, for instance, which at a more technical, as I say, granular level, the combination of those two areas. I wonder now, multiple years into owning these two sets of areas for such an enormous organization, what new insights you might have regarding the advantage of having them together?
Sure. Well, there's no question that when we did it 7 years ago, even our own people thought we were crazy. And I think today, the intersections are just becoming more and more apparent. You know, everything we're trying to do in operations, from the most manual tasks to the most sophisticated tasks, are better when they're automated. They're better and cheaper and safer when they're digital. And they perform better for customers. So everything about what it takes to be a classic operations organization, it's not just technology, it's not just nice to have, it's a real requirement. By the same token, technology has to perform. It's nothing if it doesn't perform, and the operations team's contributions every day to platform stability, to ensuring that there's a technological experience but also a human experience, the intersection of those disciplines, even if we weren't doing it, even if we hadn't done it for 7 years, our customers would be requiring it of us, I think.
That's interesting. The rise of artificial intelligence has been quite profound in recent years. And I know that you actually prefer, rather than artificial intelligence, to refer to a responsible automated intelligence. I wonder if you could define the term and the reason for a preference in that terminology versus the more typical terminology, but also then its application here at B of A.
I don't like artificial is because it sounds fake to me. artificial is by definition fake. It's partly a linguistic preference, but really intelligence is created by humans, even if it's run on an automated basis. A lot of the way I think about artificial intelligence is to think about it as algorithmic intelligence as well, because what takes data and produces an outcome are, in fact, algorithms that are written and overseen and governed and managed by people. So I think it's better, more predictable, faster, typically cheaper, much lower error rate, as long as our algorithms work, to think about all of the applications for artificial intelligence. But if you think about them, we've been doing them for a lot longer than people think. No kidding, it is the lexicon and the term of the day. But we've been using models to create credit scores for 20 years, for 25 years. You know, so you can go through a lot of different elements of banking and say, this is a much more sophisticated, much more tech-enabled deployment of automated or artificial intelligence, but it's not something we're not used to, which I think is important.
Mm-hmm. And the use of responsible, I'm curious about that as well. Is it a recognition that the topic is one where if it's not planned appropriately, that there are safety implications to it? Or how do you think of the responsibility aspect?
Models should improve decision-making. And yet poorly constructed models can actually bias decision-making. Just because it's algorithmic or automated doesn't mean it's unbiased. So, for example, we try to make sure that our lending activities are not biased geographically, so that everybody, in the case of a mortgage, has an opportunity for home ownership regardless of the zip code where they live or want to buy a house. If you create a model that doesn't have zip code, fine, you may think it's unbiased. But in reality, if you put several zip code proxies into that model, you can create a biased outcome. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about the rapid rise of artificial and automated intelligence, and yet how do we ensure it's responsible? So it's no surprise a few seconds ago I used words like govern and oversight. And at the end of the day, the automated vehicle, the artificially intelligent vehicle, will have to make a choice. Does it hit a tree? Does it hit a deer? Does it hit someone crossing the street? Mm-hmm. We'll have to make those choices. Drivers make those choices every day. And to think of an algorithm that would make that decision and to think of it potentially being irresponsible, I think is the great challenge that's going to face us. It's one of the reasons I'm not one of those believers that artificial intelligence decimates the workforce, then makes humans obsolete, because while they may not be performing the actual decision in the moment, they are certainly creating every element of the framework that gets to that decision.
Well said. You're also a big proponent of AI and data. Understanding that data will make or break some companies, you've said, I know, in the past. Talk a bit about that. And I'd also be interested in the extent to which you can share any of the insights as to how Bank of America is taking advantage of data. You've got data in so many disparate places in a company of this size. That process of wrangling that together to make better decisions, I'd be interested to understand how you and your team do that.
We're doing it better every day. We'll come to that in just a second. But, you know, I think of data as probably one of the most important natural resources of our time. And yet, how we harness it determines whether it's just a rainstorm or it's a rainstorm that produces water, that produces irrigation and produces crops. And I really try to think of it in those terms, which is, how do you take the big universe of data but make it usable in a way that changes lives, changes worlds, changes product opportunities, and makes things better? That takes brilliant architecture. It takes brilliant storage and transportation of data. And it takes very well protected data, something that is increasingly horrifically hard to do. Any outcome we want to generate, back to the AI discussion, is foundational to the discussion of data and vice versa. Probably for us at Bank of America, no matter how good we are at it today, it's probably our resource that's the most untapped. We're, in many cases, I think, in our infancy of thinking about how we go from all the data that we have in disparate places to how we actually drive toward our mission, which is to make customers and clients' financial lives better. So every element of what my team does, first trying to get very, very crisp and very streamlined, but also agile, little a in agile, about our data. Because I think of what we do as the manufacturing part of data. And then how we work with the businesses so that they understand the capabilities that the data has and also how to access it and get it.
That's great. I wanted to ask you a bit about fintech is an area that's getting a tremendous amount of investment. Venture capital, for instance, is a lot of money in there. And I think there's a tendency sometimes in seeing some of the successes of companies that are rapidly rising in that space to have sort of a woe is me type of perspective towards the incumbents, the digital immigrants, if you will, relative to the digital natives. But there are tremendous advantages as well to having scale, to having a customer base, to having all this data that you've been collecting and drawing insights and inferences from across decades. And I wonder what your own perspective is about the advantages of the major enterprise relative to the startups, and just even your own perspective about how fintech is evolving.
Well, you know, probably the last time we talked, I would have told you that I believed that at Bank of America, we were a fintech company, or some words like that. I actually have concluded that that's not true. We're not a fintech company, and we're never going to be a fintech company. We are highly regulated. We're not unregulated. Our margins are razor thin, so the idea of fail fast and fail often does not work in a business where your gross margin, forget your net margin, where your gross margin in a wildly good year might be a little bit under 2%. So fail fast and big is not in our lexicon. And our shareholders are value driven. They want a predictable performance. They want a dividend. When it's appropriate, they want share repurchases. And so a VC funding model, which can be more patient and certainly more entrepreneurial by its design, because it's designed to produce outsized returns, doesn't fit the way a large public company is constructed. So the basic building blocks of fintech will never be ours. That said, we have got to be great, I think, in big business at doing three things. We've got to be great at working with and buying from fintech companies, teaching them how to do business at scale, enabling technologies that work at one volume or rate or capacity and enabling them to work at another, enabling fintech companies to wade through the labyrinth of all the, for lack of a better term, red tape that we appropriately, in my opinion, but that we put them through. Okay, so we've got to be brilliant at being able to buy from fintech companies, because by definition, there are times they will be better and faster and think of something we haven't thought of. Second thing we've got to learn how to do is partner differently. You know, the Apple Pay model is a model where we share economics. It isn't that we buy from a vendor. When a client or a customer uses Apple Pay, we share together in that economics. And that's a different business model completely. Large companies aren't always good at partnering. And so we are trying to be on the cutting edge of what partnership can look like and thinking about the economics differently. So that's another trend. And then there are times we just have to be brilliant competitors. And there are things that fintech companies occasionally are or try to do that are existentially to us. And we have to use fintech to make us better in those existential moments, I think. There are lots of advantages to being big. I can invest heavily and do invest heavily in information and data protection. We can be ubiquitous. The cities where we operate, you'll see a lot of Bank of America and a lot of Bank of America ATMs. We can be ubiquitous from a distribution perspective. And we can ride out, because of our diversification, we can ride out the variability in any individual idea or business that we've got. Not every idea we've got has to work, and not every business we're in has to be wildly profitable at the exact same time, because scale gives us diversification.
Mm-hmm. Great points. You alluded to the sanctity of security, risk mitigation, obviously very important concepts in any company, all the more so in an organization like Bank of America. What is your approach to ensuring that as you are taking some, as innovation dictates some calculated risks, that there's also the sort of balance of that of risk mitigation as well? How do you kind of hold those in balance as you're weighing the portfolio of ideas to pursue?
It's partly why we can be slower to market, meaning not that we like to be, but that we can be, because a small mistake or a small vulnerability across 30 million households in the United States, is just as one example, it could be extremely systemically damaging. And so I think first and foremost, we take the responsibility seriously. We're in the trust business with our clients and our customers. So if you were to ask me, you know, our CEO might have a formal definition of what our brand is. To me, when you have someone's money, the definition of our brand is trust. we take it seriously for that reason. Part of the way we think about it is, of course, about investment. Part of the way we think about it is a structured design process to our work so that, again, so we test avidly. Part of the way we think about it is talent. Honestly, in the information security space, but also in the technology space overall, if you ask me today versus 2 or 3 years ago, today the thing that keeps me awake the most, it's talent. Whether you're designing a defense system, executing a defense system at the point at which someone might be trying to attack you, those are judgments that have to be made on a second-by-second basis. And so our way of thinking about it, truly, four words, best tech, best talent. War for talent, I have actually never in my career felt so acutely. And it's a 35-year career, which I'm almost embarrassed to say. Never felt as much as I feel it today.
That's interesting.
So there's a high demand for great technologists who can also lead businesses and lead teams. All of us, whether it's tech sector, financial services, defense, we're all chasing the same people.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about a variety of topics, automated intelligence, data analytics. We've just spoken a bit about security. A number of areas, especially in technology, that are rising in importance. I wonder the sorts of skills that you're looking for today, especially as different from when you first took the post. How do you see that evolving as you're thinking about the war for talent, as you're thinking about building a great team that is not just reflecting the technology and the strategy of today, but also of tomorrow, of years from now? How do you think about the sorts of skills that are rising in importance?
More than anything, the difference today versus 5 years ago is we have to look 5 years out. Whatever we thought was our leadership model has to be reconstructed. And I've been spending quite a bit of time with my management team to literally construct what we call leader attributes of the future. Naturally digital. Doesn't matter if you're an operations person or a technologist. Naturally digitally thinking. People who have a high capability to drive change. So not can execute change, but are change hungry. We were laughing the other day. How can you talk about Moore's Law anymore with the pace of change? You can, but it's a whole new Moore's Law. Mm-hmm. And we have to have people who aren't just resilient in change, they have to love it. So we've really set out probably 25 different leader attributes, and everything from how we develop our people internally to how we hire will be based off that set of attributes. One of the things, to me, especially in a large organization, that's really important is this notion, and I hate the term, so you can laugh at me for creating a term that I actually hate as well, exponential thinking. Leaving behind the land of 2%, 5%, 8% change and saying, how can I take the technology of today and or the capabilities of today and stand something on its side and produce an exponential outcome? So we spent a lot of time, I'll pick something pedantic, we spent a lot of time trying to get our consumer customers to change from getting their bank statements on paper to getting them electronic. We set goals. Can we move from 25 to 30 to 40%? The kind of thinking we need as we go forward is, no, wait a minute. How do I ensure that in no circumstances is a new account opened at Bank of America that does anything other than electronic statements? And why isn't the goal 100%? And what does it take to get from 40 to 100 versus 40 to 45? And it sounds easy. It just sounds like expand the goal. It's not really like that. It is how do you turn the problem on its side from how it's been thought of traditionally in order to do what fintech companies do because they're starting from nothing? How do you make real, true, no cliche, real, true leaps?
Another playbook item for companies that are starting from nothing is to largely have cloud-based technology. And there's been a lot of debate, generally speaking, large enterprises, but financial services more specifically, about the wisdom of leveraging the cloud, especially public clouds. And I'd be curious in your perspectives on that.
Believe it or not, I've had to change my mind. I've had to change my point of view. Very painful, but yes. And the reason is this. When we first really started talking about clouds, turning fixed assets into variable assets, turning fixed capacity into variable capacity 5 or 6 years ago in earnest. There have been people, pioneers, talking about it and doing it for maybe 10 years, but in earnest 5 or 6 years ago. The capability to protect oneself in a public cloud environment is not nearly what it is today and most definitely isn't what it will be 5 years from now. So rather than what I would have said to you again, two or three years ago, which is no Bank of America on the public cloud. Never happen. I actually don't believe. I believe there's a day where it will happen. First thing to know is with scale comes the ability to virtualize our assets on our own. We run a cloud. It is our own cloud. Then we are making lots of different forays into what I call multi-tenant clouds. Workdays of the world, the Salesforces of the world, Oracles, other working with other companies on whose architecture and infrastructure we can ride for the times we need variable capacity or the times when we can be more efficient in a multi-tenant environment that is still different from public cloud. You know, public cloud to me is anyone who wants to pay can play. And that environment is much tougher to secure. You'll see us announce some things over the next probably 3 months where we're going to dip our toe into the water of having some partnerships where we can, when we have the right work and when the safety and security is where we are comfortable with it, or at least comfortable enough to test, we are going to begin to explore our limited, very limited in the beginning, but our use of public cloud. Because what I can't afford is when it's safe and secure, which it will be, I can't afford to be flat-footed. For the most part, right now, what we want to do will continue to just predominantly, but virtually all in-house. There are occasions where we'll work with third parties in a multiple-tenant environment. And slowly but surely, we and others will drive the public cloud to a safety level that works.
I want to turn our attention to a topic we also covered in the past. In recent years, you've added a couple of board affiliations since our last conversation. You are not necessarily an exhaustive list, but on the boards of Zurich Insurance Group, Florida Blue, UNC Charlotte, the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Now that you've had a greater depth of experience with boards, and as that partial list would suggest, boards that are academic, that are for-profit businesses in multiple industries, the sorts of advantages you've garnered from working with such a diverse array of not only companies, but your fellow board members in those organizations?
There's not a single question that my board involvement makes me better at what I do, period. Also, I believe it builds more well-rounded person, and that, by definition, I think, makes me also better at what I do. And I see it for my colleagues and peers and the teams I work with. There's a real difference in people who have outside perspective. Zurich is my first public board, so that's a very interesting experience to look at capital and to look at a balance sheet that aren't ours at the bank, and to think about customers differently, to think about policy versus execution, which is what being on a corporate board requires. Those things are all stimulating. They're impactful on me, and I hope as I go forward on the company. And the sophistication of the people I sit around the table with and their ability to spur thoughts. I came back from my first Zurich meeting with pages of notes, partly, yes, on the company, but also partly on the ideas that were stimulated from listening to the questioning and the thoughts of the other board members. So it's a leadership lesson. It's a breadth of perspective lesson. It's reflective, and I got to tell you, as a person who has to make presentations to boards, to my board, which I do, it makes me better even at that, because I know what a board expects. I know what they, and I know what they don't care about.
Yeah. Having been on boards for a while now, I'd also be interested, as somebody who's had worn a number of hats across the various business disciplines, but technology is among those. The questions that are coming up related to technology, the appetite or curiosity about the opportunities and threats represented in as grand a topic as technology. Can you talk a bit about how that's evolved to the extent to which the concerns weigh more towards security issues as opposed to innovation, for instance?
Mm-hmm. I think there's pull for both, actually, for an avid discussion at the board level around protection and security, but also a real worry across boards. And I see our clients' boards, too. A real worry across boards as to whether they're being quick enough, agile enough, are they innovating enough. Sometimes I think that the risk of the high-level policy conversations around technology at literally the wide variety of boards I get an opportunity to see, the risk is an oversimplification or a belief that technology cures everything. Go back to the responsible AI discussion. It's not enough to have it. It has to be great, right? So I do worry about that. I worry about the natural belief that more is better in the technology space, because sometimes the discussion is, well, let's flip the switch now. I would tell you this. One thing, having, as you know, run several businesses at the bank and 4 years at what I think is the hardest job in the company, which is chief marketing officer. I'm still in therapy from that one. But having done all of that wide variety of things, I marvel at still, with all that knowledge, how much I thought you could flip a switch and make change in technology. And how much I thought you could guarantee from an operations perspective that you could guarantee operational perfection. What have I learned? There is no switch that can get flipped that's instant change. I've also learned that it always does, in fact, come down to the guy in the data center who actually trips over the cord and pulls it out of the wall. So there is no such thing as foolproof. And it's the complexity of what we try to get right every day. It's why I have so much respect for my peers, because the complexity of what we try to get right every day can be underappreciated. Maybe underappreciated isn't the right word. Maybe it can be not well understood. The need to be thinking about resiliency, about plan B, about talent, those things are all much more complicated than I ever thought 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, as they manage their career, have a tendency to grow in a silo of a business. So they are an operations new employee, and they work their way up the chain in operations or marketing or finance or technology, for instance. You're a bit ahead of your time, I would suggest, in as much as you've sort of meandered across a variety of disciplines. And I can only imagine that you today draw from all of those in your current role. And so as a result, you have the advantage not only of depth, but also breadth. And it strikes me this is really another tremendous advantage of a business at scale, is that there's the opportunity, if you've got a high potential person who sits under a high potential person, as an example, who is not going anywhere, that there's the possibility of taking the junior of those two in that example and give him or her a set of experiences in other parts of the organization, lose them, so to speak, to a different division as opposed to a different company. Right. And then as they come back, they have so much richer a set of perspectives and experiences that they can bring to bear to that original division, or perhaps not, as the case may be. As you reflect upon that, I want to test that hypothesis and see if you find that it's correct. But secondly, I'd be curious the extent to which this is sort of something that's worked into the way that Bank of America operates, generally speaking, providing both breadth and depth of experience.
First of all, I think in some of the technical disciplines or the functional disciplines, like a finance, like risk, like technology, like operations, historically, we have valued that silo, right? And so not only have organizations not always been good at creating that wide breadth of development, people in functional disciplines have not embraced it. So there are still times when I'll say to someone, no, go spend 3 years in this business and you'll come back a better technologist, a better operating person. You will be of more value to the firm. There are times I still have to talk people into that discussion. And yet, I don't know how I'd do my job if I didn't have that perspective. I really don't, because anymore, there is no front office and back office. Technology actually has completely changed the notion of business integration to say, sometimes the business is technology and sometimes technology enables the business. They're really one in the same. So first of all, I do think your hypothesis is 100% correct. Scale helps, and I the only reason I've had a 35-year career here is because there isn't a discipline I haven't been exposed to. Heck, I can play lawyer when I want to some days, because we've got always had things going on from a technology perspective with our legal team. So that I've never had to leave the firm to change my opportunity to learn. And I think that is a benefit of scale and something we focus on. It's funny, I was just thinking, my boss often says that part of his challenge is to keep me on a learning curve, because otherwise I create crises. You know, an idle mind can create all kinds of havoc. So really, it's in the best interest of the firm that I've had this kind of career. But we do it very deliberately. I'm required every year to do a talent planning analysis, in fact, twice a year. We've been doing them for 20 years. Typically, I can tell you who on my team is ready for the next development move and who is not. And I can probably tell you that three deep into my organization. So for my top 1,000 people, 700 people, I can tell you that, because we're very disciplined about how we look at career assignment and career rotations. I set goals for myself for both the importing and exporting of talent. over the last year, I have a new head of global markets, sales, and trading operations. He came from the business. He used to run Global Treasury Services, the global cash management businesses, and most recently ran Prime Brokerage, a heavy element of the sales and trading influence. And now he's running operations for both those businesses. Big learning opportunity for him, but based on the fact that he brings fresh perspective and real client and counterparty knowledge into the mix. So it doesn't happen by accident, but your hypothesis is spot on.
Wonderful. Well, Kathy Vasson, thank you so much for a tremendous conversation. It's always great to catch up with you to understand the sorts of things that you and your team are undertaking here at Bank of America. So thank you for taking the time with me.
Well, your questions always make me think, which I really appreciate that. So I hope I get to see you soon.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.